Yeah. ಶಿವಭಕ್ತಿ ಸರಸರಿತ ಕುಮಾರ ಶಿವಭಾರಿಕೆ ಅನಂತ ಕೋಟಿ ವೈಷ್ಣವಿನಿ ಜಯಕಾಂತಾಚಾರ್ಯ ಶಿವಭಾರಿಕೆ ಪ್ರೇಮ ಸರ್ವಶ್ರೀ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಚೈತನ್ಯ ಗುರು ನಿತ್ಯಾನಂದ ಶ್ರೀ cook with us in the kitchen, and he was always aware of everyone else's activities in addition to his own cooking. He knew exactly how things should be. He washed everything and made sure everyone did everything correctly. He was a teacher. We used to make chapatis by hand, but then one day he asked me to get him a rolling pin. I brought my rolling pin and he appropriated it. He put some men on rolling chapatis and supervised them very carefully. I made a chutney for him at home. He always accepted our gifts graciously, although I don't think he ever ate them. Perhaps he was worried we might put in something that wasn't allowed in his diet. He used to take things from me and put them in the cupboard. I don't know what he finally did with them, but I am sure he didn't throw them away. I never saw him eat anything that I had prepared, although he accepted everything. Prabhupada held his evening meetings on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, just as he had uptown. The loft was out of the way for most of his acquaintances, and it was on the Bowery. A cluster of sleeping derelicts regularly blocked the street-level entrance, and visitors would find as many as half a dozen bums to step over before climbing the four flights of stairs. But it was something new. You could go and sit with a group of hip people and watch the Swami lead kirtan. The room was dimly lit, and Prabhupada would burn incense. Many casual visitors came and went. One of them, Gunthar, had vivid impressions. Gunthar. He walked right off the Bowery into a room filled with incense. It was quiet. Everyone was talking in hushed tones, not really talking at all. Swamiji was sitting in the front of the room and in meditation. There was a tremendous feeling of peace which I had never had before. I happened to have studied for 2 years to become a minister and was into meditation, study, and prayer. But this was my first time to do anything Eastern or Hindu. There were lots of pillows around and mats on the floor for people to sit on. I don't think there were any pictures or statues. It was just Swamiji, incense, and mats, and obviously the respect of the people in the room for him. Before we went up, Carl was laughing and saying how Swami wanted everyone to use the hand symbols just correctly. I had never played the symbols before, but when it began, I just tried to follow Swamiji, who was doing it in a certain way. Things were building up. The sound was building up. But then someone was doing it wrong. And Swamiji was very, very calmly, shook a finger at someone and they looked, and then everything stopped. He instructed this person from a distance, and this fellow got the right idea, and they started up again. After just a few minutes, the sound of the cymbals and the incense, we weren't in the Bowery any longer. We started chanting Hare Krishna. That was my first experience in chanting. I'd never chanted before. There's nothing in Protestant religion that comes even close to that. Maybe Catholics with their Hail Marys, but it's not quite the same thing. It was just relaxing and very interesting to be able to chant, and I found Swamiji very fascinating. The loft was more open than Prabhupada's previous place uptown, so there was less privacy. And here some of the visitors were skeptical and even challenging, but everyone found him confident and joyful. He seemed to have far-reaching plans and he had dedication. He knew what he wanted to do and was single-handedly carrying it out. "It is not one man's job," he said. But he went on doing all he could, depending on Krishna for the results. David was beginning to help, and more people were coming to visit him. Almost all of Prabhupada's Bowery friends were musicians or friends of musicians. They were into music, drugs, women, and spiritual meditation. Because Prabhupada's presentation of the Hare Krishna mantra was both musical and meditative, they were automatically interested. Prabhupada stressed that all the Vedic mantras or hymns were sung. In fact, the words Bhagavad Gita meant the song of God. But the words of the Vedic hymns were incarnations of God in the form of transcendental sound. The musical accompaniment of hand cymbal, drum, and harmonium was just that, an accompaniment, and had no spiritual purpose independent of the chanting of the name of God. Prabhupada allowed any instrument to be used as long as it did not detract from the chanting. Carol. It was very interracial music. It was a very interracial music-oriented scene. There were a few professional musicians and a lot of people who enjoyed playing or just listening. Some people were painting in some of the lofts, and that's basically what was going on. We had memorable kirtans. One time there was a beautiful ceremony. Some of us went over early to prepare for it. There must have been 100 people who came that day. For the Bowery crowd, sound was spirit, and spirit was sound, in a merging of music and meditation. But for Prabhupada, music without the name of God wasn't meditation. It was sense gratification, or at most, a kind of stylized, impersonal meditation. But he was glad to see the musicians coming to play along in his kirtans, to hear him and to chant responsibly. Some, having stayed up all night playing somewhere on their instruments, would come by in the morning and sing with the Swami. He did not dissuade them from their focus on sound. Rather, he gave them sound. In the Vedas, sound is said to be the first element of material creation. The source of sound is God, and God is eternally a person. Prabhupada's emphasis was on getting people to chant God's personal transcendental name. Whether they took it as jazz, folk music, rock, or Indian meditation made no difference, as long as they began to chant Hare Krishna. Carol. Whenever he had the chanting, the people were fairly in awe of the Swami. On the Bowery, a kind of transcendence came out of the ringing of the cymbals. He used the harmonium, and many people played hand cymbals. Sometimes he played the drum. In the very beginning, he stressed the importance of sound and the realization of Godhead through sound. That was, I suppose, the attraction that these musicians found in him, the emphasis on sound as a means of attaining transcendence and the Godhead. But he wanted a serious thing. He was interested in discipleship. Reminded of an incident, but his sentence for Prabhupada, music without the name of God wasn't meditation, it was sense gratification, or at most a kind of stylized and personal meditation. So Hare Keshav told me that once he was on an airplane with Prabhupada, these Air India 747s used to have pictures of Krishna on the wall. It looked like wallpaper, and there was a picture of Krishna sitting in a tree with the garments of the gopis. And there was another picture. There were two different, but they repeated over and over again. That's what the inside of the airline used to look like, airplanes. So on one particular day, this is the story that he told me, he was sitting with Prabhupada on one of those airplanes, and the music was also kind of Indian, and some Ravi Shankar music was playing. And the story he told me went like this, and he was kind of nodding his head to the music, to the beat, and Prabhupada noticed him, and he turned to him and said, "That's sense gratification." And I just kind of put his head down and said, "Yes," and just waited, and then Prabhupada kind of looked over at him and smiled and said, "It's very nice sense gratification." From Srimad Bhagavatam, 3rd canto, 5th chapter, 42nd verse. Yes? Yach.
Yach.
Shradaya.
Shradaya.
Shrutavatya.
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 Samrijyamane.
Samrijyamane.
Hridaye.
Hridaye.
Podaya.
Podaya.
Janena.
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 Vairagya,
Alena,
Dira,
Rajeva,
Tate,
Tatingri,
Saruja,
Hitam, Yashradaya,
Shrutavatya,
Yashradaya, Shrutavatya, Shabakya,
Yashradaya, Shrutavatya, Shabakya,
Vijamane, Hridaye, Vadaya, simply by hearing.
Cha,
also. Bhaktya,
in devotion.
Samrijyamane,
being cleansed.
Vidaye,
in the heart.
Avadhaya,
meditation.
Jnanena, by knowledge.
Vairagya,
detachment.
Balena,
by the strength of.
Hira,
to pacify.
Rajema,
must go to.
Tat,
that.
Te,
your.
Angri,
be.
Sarojapitam,
lotus sanctuary. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Simply by hearing about your lotus feet with eagerness and devotion and by meditating upon them within the heart. One at once becomes enlightened with knowledge, and on the strength of detachment, one becomes pacified. We must therefore take shelter in the sanctuary of your lotus feet. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The miracles of meditating on the lotus feet of the Lord with eagerness and devotion are so great that no other process can compare to it. The minds of materialistic persons are so disturbed that it is almost impossible for them to search after the supreme truth by personal, regulated endeavors. But even such materialistic men, with a little eagerness for hearing about the transcendental name, fame, qualities, etc., can surpass all other methods of attaining knowledge and detachment. The conditioned soul is attached to the bodily conception of the self, and therefore he is in ignorance. Culture of self-knowledge can bring about detachment from material affections, and without such detachment, there is no meaning to knowledge. The most stubborn attachment for material enjoyment is sex life. One who is attracted to sex life is to be understood as devoid of knowledge. Knowledge must be followed by detachment. That is the way of self-realization. These two essentials for self-realization, knowledge and detachment, become manifest very quickly if one performs devotional service to the lotus feet of the Lord. The word dhīra is very significant in this connection. A person who is not disturbed, even in the presence of cause of disturbance, is called dhīra. Sri Jamunacharya says, Since my heart has been overwhelmed by the devotional service of Lord Krishna, I cannot even think of sex life, and the thoughts of sex come upon me, I at once feel disgust. A devotee of the Lord becomes an elevated deva by the simple process of meditating in eagerness on the lotus feet of the Lord. Devotional service entails being initiated by a bona fide spiritual master and following his instruction in regard to hearing about the Lord. Such a bona fide spiritual master is accepted by regularly hearing from him about the Lord. The improvement in knowledge and detachment can be perceived by devotees as an actual experience. Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu strongly recommended this process of hearing from a bona fide devotee, and by following this process, one can achieve the highest result, conquering all other methods. Shraddhaya Shrutavatya Chabakya Samridhamane Vidaye Vidaya Yanena Vairagya Valena Dira Vajema Tattengri Saroja Dipam. Simply by hearing about your lotus feet with eagerness and devotion. Simply by hearing about your lotus feet with eagerness and devotion, and by meditating upon them within the heart, one at once becomes enlightened with knowledge, and on the strength of detachment, one becomes pacified. We must therefore take shelter of the sanctuary. We must therefore take shelter of the sanctuary of your lotus feet. So, are you here for the first time? I should mention that in the English language, it was custom, to speak about humanity in terms of man, and Prabhupada adhered to this convention. But actually when he says his or man, he's referring to humans, so it doesn't exclude the female gender. Let me make that clear. Is defining knowledge here as being imperfect unless detachment follows. In other words, real knowledge means that one has to become detached from material affection. There are many forms of knowledge, and what we call knowledge, if it is devoid of this detachment, is not, according to Prabhupada's teachings, real knowledge. And this is stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam too, that we must have vairagya and we must have jnana followed by vairagya, knowledge followed by detachment. If one doesn't become detached from the material nature, then that knowledge is imperfect. So there are many who are versed in various fields of knowledge, and we've heard about the spontaneous Varnashram system that exists. Varnashram meaning the division of society into four different divisions: the intellectuals, the administrators, the money people, the landholders, the capitalists, I might say, and the agriculturalists or farmers. In today's world, we can experience these divisions, but sometimes they're known as spontaneous divisions. They're not really designated as such. We don't have intellectuals, we don't have workers, we don't have administrators, we don't have capitalists. I mean, we do, but we don't see that our society is divided into four different divisions like that. But it does exist, so it, therefore it's sometimes known as a spontaneous system of division, not really there. So the gyanis, or the learned, the professors, the so-called experts in various fields, are generally devoid of the principle of detachment. So intellect can be measured in many different ways. It can be measured by how expert people are in IQ, how expert people are in music, and I've read that some people who have very low IQs can tell you what the day of the year was on May 3rd, 1453, instantaneously. So there are different types of intelligence. And the type of intelligence being described here is the type that means that one is understands that there's another dimension to life, that I can become detached from material energy, that everything that I hold near and dear to me, all the different types of affection that I experience, are things that I have to detach myself from, ultimately, because otherwise, any amount of knowledge is not really true knowledge. It's just knowing things, knowing facts, numbers. So the Bhagavatam is a little strict in this regard, that knowledge is devoid of purpose or devoid of meaning unless there is detachment from material nature. So real knowledge means to understand that dimension of life, that I have to become, I have to free myself from these different types of affection. That's real knowledge. So Prabhupada talks about the miracles of meditating on a lotus feet. Now usually a miracle is something that people don't understand. That's what we mean by miracle. Some friends of mine told me, they're practicing medicine now, that throughout their studies in biology and in medicine, in these different fields of learning, they came across this phrase, the miracle of evolution, over and over again. So that's the standard wisdom of biology and medicine, that something called evolution existed as Darwin posited. And that's the basis upon which the whole medical establishment has grown up and become part of our life. So that's considered a miracle. And so it is a miracle in the sense that nobody actually knows how it really occurs. Therefore it's a miracle. So Prabhupada uses this word miracle to talk about the lotus feet of the Lord. How can feet give knowledge? Doesn't make any sense. Feet are just part of the anatomy. But lotus feet, or the feet of Krishna, are in this other dimension, the dimension which we detach ourselves from material feet to be attached to spiritual feet. And they give knowledge. Very difficult to understand, but also very interesting. Now, one devotee, I want to read an article to you, submitted something for Dr. Godhead. And interestingly enough, it's called Padasevanam, and it talks about lotus feet. And I thought it was kind of well written, so if you'll indulge me, I'd like to read it to you. Not very long. Page and a half. This is what was written. How many fairy tales feature a beautiful princess, cruelly enslaved and neglected, who nonetheless scrubs her tender fingers raw with sweet-tempered compliance, who is never angered by her harsh situation, never envious of the wicked stepmothers or stepsisters or wizards who have stolen her fortune, who is to beggars, animals, dwarfs, and princes in strange who is kind to beggars, animals, dwarfs, and princes in strange disguises. Eventually, her kindness is wrought upon just the right person to rescue her from her drudgery, and she goes off to live the rest of her life in splendor. Now, fairy tales are just stories, but they are stories created and perpetuated by some deep longing of the human psyche. What is so appealing about this ephemeral princess that tales from every culture subject her to harsh treatment and reward her with magical salvation? Modern fantasy continually replays this theme also. The unassuming, nice guy wins the girl. The bedraggled team learns to cooperate and wins the championship. The meek inherit the earth. Again and again, virtuous service is rewarded with riches, fame, and romance. How many of us must secretly believe we are meant for better things than the toil of our everyday lives? Service defines our life's experiences. We are servants of many masters, family members, employers, and creditors all suck up our time and money. Physical needs constantly enslave us, while mental cravings drive us like insatiable tyrants. We are the servants of clocks and calendars, of public approval and trends, of traffic flow and weather changes. Just think through your daily activities, and you will see how much of it seems beyond your control. No wonder we are enchanted by the rewards of noble service. The fourth process of devotional service is padasevanam. Pada is a Sanskrit word that means feet, while sevanam means service to. Thus, padasevanam refers to service rendered to the lotus feet of the Lord. With this process of serving the Lord, we encounter a very personal aspect of his being, his feet. And while the ordinary conception of feet is not altogether pleasing, conjuring sights and smells that are left uncontemplated, the feet of the Supreme Lord are so sweetly beautiful that simply thinking of them brings devotees to tears of love and longing. The mighty demigods, composed of the sun, wind, water, and all aspects of the material world, were delighted when Lord Krishna wandered the forest of Vrindavan, leaving his footprints in the dust. And Krishna's dear friends, the gopi cowherd girls, would press this dust against their heads and hearts, lost in ecstatic trance. The Lord's feet are described in detail in the Vedic scriptures. Upon his soft, reddish-colored soles are the marks of the lotus, conch shell, club, disc, flag, thunderbolt, fish, and a rod for controlling elephants. To worship someone's feet is to accept the humblest of approaches. And yet the Lord makes this approach attractive with his exquisitely beautiful feet. Feeling an attraction for these transcendental feet automatically diminishes an attraction to temporal pleasures offered by this world. And thus it is a great spiritual blessing to worship the lotus feet of the Lord. As Brahma, a powerful demigod, prays, for one who has accepted the boat of the lotus feet of the Lord, who is a shelter of the cosmic manifestation and is famous as Murari, the enemy of the demon Mura, the ocean of the material world, is like the water contained in a calf's footprint. His goal is Parampadam, or Vaikuntha, the place where there are no material miseries, not the place where there is danger at every step. Srila Rupa Goswami offers the example. Prabhupada said that was a very poetic verse because of the way it sounds. Srila Rupa Goswami offers the example of Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune, as one who has become perfect through the process of padasevanam. Sri Lakshmi continually massages the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. This is remarkable, as noted in the Srimad Bhagavatam. The goddess of fortune, although by nature very restless and moving, could not quit the lotus feet. Bhagavatam 1.133. Most of us have some experience with this restless nature of Lakshmi. She manifests herself as wealth and good fortune, elements of material life that are painfully elusive and temporary. No mortal may control Lakshmi, although many, many waste their lives trying. Since the goddess of fortune is the devoted servant of the Lord, she will not bestow her bounty without his blessing. This leads to the great misunderstanding that permeates religious belief throughout the world. Worship God and he will answer your prayers. Temples, churches, and mosques filled with ardent practitioners bearing hidden agendas. Sometimes the plan is simple. I will go to church every week, drop some money in the collection plate, and be good. Prosperity will follow. Sometimes the situation is more poignant. A mother prays for money to pay for a child's operation. An unemployed man prays for a job. And while it is certainly the truth that God does answer prayers in this way, that faith in his benevolence is well placed. Nevertheless, prayer and other forms of worship are not bargaining chips for his favor. Think of the difference between someone who is kind to you out of love and someone who is kind to you because you will give them something. Nothing in our hearts is hidden from God. The test comes when the request is not answered, when death and poverty and illness are unchecked by even the most sincere entreaties. What happens to our faith then? Do we offer the Lord heartfelt worship even as our hearts twist in agony? Thus there is a tremendous spiritual lesson offered through Bodhisattvanam. We approach the Lord from the most humble position, as supplicants to his feet, understanding that even the goddess of fortune approaches him in this way. All wealth, all honor, all fortune are but his servants. When the Lord does not employ these servants as our own, can we continue to supplicate ourselves at his feet? Can we aspire to serve in the mood of the goddess of fortune, humble and unexpected, content with the opportunity to render the lowliest of service? For some, the answer is a definitive no. The image of the goddess bent over the feet of the master echoes the harsh dominion of men over women, often experienced in this world. These are not transcendent images, but examples of patriarchal hierarchy entrenched within religious systems, constructed by mortal men. Women serve, men enjoy. One more excuse for men to squash women into nothingness. One more excuse for women to reject religious discipline. How easy it could be to interpret Lakshmi's service in this way, as nothing more than an example of a wife, of a wife's submission to her husband. The real significance of Lakshmi's dedicated service has little to do with the bodies we have assumed in this life. After all, in previous and future lives, we have inhabited various bodies, sometimes male, sometimes female. These are all temporary designations. In this spiritual sense, none of us are burdened by dominant or submissive roles except in relation to the Supreme Lord. Srila Prabhupada explains, the living beings are by constitution feminine in nature. The male or enjoyer is the Lord, and all manifestations of his different potencies are feminine by nature. The dominating role of men in this world, so often misunderstood as inherent superiority, indicates but a temporary relationship between embodied living entities. Men, women, trees, and stones are all equally meant to serve God. Thus, Lakshmi's service need cause no resentment or pride for any of us, because she is more than simply a role model for good wives. She performs the task most treasured by all realized souls, the gentle massaging of the Lord's loved feet. Let us return to our fairy tale princess. She has toiled for her ungrateful master without expecting the wondrous opulence that will someday be hers. And once she ascends to a position of wealth and authority, does she forget the pleasures of her simple service? Does she begin to believe that she has earned her brand new fortune, that she deserves it, and that it is hers? Can she remember a time when the fortune was not there, and contemplate the time she will leave it all behind? Fairy tales are supposed to have happy endings, and yet we might fast forward to the moment the princess faces death. Faces the loss of all she has come to love, and wonders if meeting the prince was such a boon after all. Wealth, beauty, fame, and all other opulences are wonderful things, but they are meant to be engaged, as is their mistress Lakshmi Devi, in continual service of the Supreme Lord. That is kind of an interesting article. it points out that we're after success and opulence and wealth and good education, so many things to improve ourselves along the path of material enjoyment. But at some point, they must come to an end. And just as we might not have had them in the first place, we're not going to have them in the end. That's kind of what's being said here. It's also said that we come into the world naked and we leave the world naked. So whatever we acquire in this life is only as temporary as this life itself is. This is the mood or the understanding of someone who is really intelligent or really detached, that whatever I own, whatever I have, it's only here temporarily. And more importantly, or equally importantly anyway, is that everything that I possess isn't actually mine. It belongs to the Supreme Lord. My country, my community, my job, my friends, my family, my own body, my own mind, ultimately are owned by the Supreme Lord. Sometimes we think that being detached from material nature means that it really doesn't matter what our place of living looks like, doesn't matter what we wear, doesn't matter what our cars look like. But actually, if we meditate on the fact that everything belongs to Krishna, to God, we're going to take care of all these things extra well. we're going to need to be very careful about what our place of living looks like and how we dress and how we speak. Because everything belongs to God. So it has to be very carefully maintained. It should be better maintained than those who don't think God owns everything. Because if it's owned by the Supreme Lord and He's the Supreme Perfect Master of everything, then everything should be just, everything that He owns should be just pukka, should be absolutely perfect. So Prabhupada talks about, you know, how hearing with ears is very important. I think I mentioned this before, but Śrīla Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Prabhupada's guru talked about two different classes of devotees. He talked about the hearing devotees and the dandava devotees. And I thought that was very interesting because the dandava devotees are the people implied here that follow all the rituals very meticulously. Maybe they're guilty of niyamagraha, following them blindly. But they can be very submissive. They come down and they offer their prostrated dandavas. They lie flat before the deities and before the spiritual master and before the saintly persons. And these are what he calls the dandava devotees. People in sales have this term, the laydowns. The people that are very easy to sell things to because they don't have a mind of their own. So that's kind of interesting because the dandava is a sort of lying.